Andrew is a follower of John the Baptist. He is the one in the group that is involved. He's the worker. He's the devoted one. He's there. And after John baptizes Jesus, he tells Andrew about it, about him, who Jesus really is. And Andrew gets his brother, Simon Peter, and takes him to Jesus. And Jesus renames Simon, calling him Peter. And this is the day before the text begins with the next day. So then Philip knows Andrew and Peter. And like Andrew, Philip brings someone to Jesus, who is then to be brought into the fold. There's something about these interactions that I find deeply significant. And not so much significant in the way that it bears the historical weight, that this is some sort of big historical significance, right? Like the big moments in which history is made. We say that is history right there as it's happening, right? This is not that. This is not an iconic moment. It's not Martin Luther King Jr. on the steps in front of the Lincoln Memorial. It's not a defining moment kind of significant. It's significant in a physical way, in this experiential way, in the way that when something happens in life, we remember it. Significant. And these people hear about Jesus, and they need to see him. They need to sense Jesus. So this is much more than proof of Jesus. This is living it. This is getting it and knowing it in their bones, right? That this person that they're being told about, this is the Messiah, the guy that they've been waiting for. Right? The one the people, our people, have been hoping for centuries would come, would arrive in their midst. This is what we've been praying for. This is the one who changes everything. Right? And he is here. And he wants us to be there. So we, in the midst of all of this, when we're dealing with our text and we're dealing with these people and we're dealing with this fuzzy history, we begin to struggle with the literal, right? This historical, the factual, the nature of this, right? And I blame the Enlightenment. Before then, we didn't really confuse truth and fact. It just was there. It just was. True was true, regardless of how it happened. Then we started to obsess about how things happened. And we started to believe that there was this objective reality, if only we could know it. That we could say, this is how it happened. As if our experience of an objective reality didn't instantly make the reality subjective. So now we're in this post-Enlightenment world, we call it postmodern, in which such objective view of the world is quaint and near impossible. Tony Jones describes this using an umpire analogy. He's not the first. There are three umpires hanging out after a baseball game. The pre-modern umpire says, "There are balls and there are strikes, and I call them what they are." And the modern umpire says, there are balls and there are strikes, and I call them as I see them. And the postmodern umpire says, there are balls and there are strikes, and they ain't nothing until I call them. This confusion of truth and fact, how things happen, are why we need to see something to believe it, right? Why belief is so clearly involved and intertwined with seeing, right? Not just hearing about it, we see it. And the patron saint of this last 200 years, this Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment time, ought to be Thomas, who at the opposite end of this gospel isn't satisfied with hearing about a resurrected Christ. He's not satisfied with that, is he? Right? He asks, he demands the opportunity to have what they had, to see in the flesh, see Jesus there, to believe that Jesus has been come back from the dead, right? And not just really seeing, let's be honest, he has to touch the flesh. And it could be a body double, right? So let's stick our hands in those holes and shove the finger in the side. Let's prove that this is Jesus. He has to see it for himself. There's something very natural about seeing, about our need for proof, about making this true. When Philip tells Nathanael about Jesus, Nathanael doesn't really believe it's possible, right? This guy is from Nazareth, of all places. What are the chances? But Philip urges him, come and see. And Jesus sees Nathanael and declares that he is honest. How does Jesus know Nathanael is honest? Well, he saw Nathanael under the fig tree. But Jesus undermines this line of thought, right? This line that goes from seeing to believing, by saying, do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these. And he describes what will be and what he will see. The heavens opening, right? And the coming of the Son of Humanity. But this all begins with Philip, who invites his friend, saying, come and see. And I'd like to think that Philip gets this double meaning, that he's with it enough. He has followed John. He's already seen Jesus. And he gets this double meaning, that he is inviting his friend to come with him and, yes, see what all the fuss is about, right? Come and see if this really is the Messiah. And that he is inviting him, this friend, to come with him and understand, right? Come and see the coming Messiah. For Jesus, seeing isn't only done with our eyes. And it is not only believing, it is all tied up together with honesty and knowledge and the stuff as one tangled mess, right? Seeing may be believing, but honesty is what makes Nathanael special and different. It is natural to wonder, of course, then, what it is that Jesus actually did see. What it was specifically that made him know that there is no deceit in Nathanael. Because Nathanael's response seems like he was caught doing something, That it was that there was a something that he and Jesus could figure out was seen. But it's not something salacious, right? It's something good. Something that Philip and Andrew couldn't know and couldn't have told him. It is curious, like a big chunk of text is missing. What really happened, we ask? But this is not the least bit important to John. What happened doesn't matter at all, in fact. There's no need to describe it, no need to get that specific, because we don't need to see along with Jesus to believe that Nathanael is honest or that Jesus knows that he is. We don't need to see that Jesus called these followers or that Jesus lived and breathed and walked or that Jesus was lifted up on a cross. We do not need to see Jesus in the flesh again to believe that he was raised from the dead. We believe without seeing anything. So for many of us, we come to see after we believe. When we are have dealt with our doubts and our self-deceits and all of the junk that prevents us from seeing, and we give God a chance to actually show up and be seen by us, that's when we start to see. That's been my experience. When I took to heart Jesus' instructions to not worry about what you are to say, because God will provide the words. And I stood up in front of a congregation for the first time without the benefit of a text and some comfort, a knowledge of what I'm about to say, and the words came anyway. And they weren't bad, by the way. I began to see it elsewhere and hear it, too. I get calls. Only then did I know what trust was, what honesty was. Because I had to trust that God was going to do it. I had to trust that I could believe God would give those words when they were needed. I had to trust. And when I did, it worked. So only then could I know what being honest to God was like. And being honest to my friends then, being honest to each other. So wherever we are on our journeys, may we be without deceit. May we believe, and may we see God here in one another and in everyone we meet.